Hello and welcome. On behalf of CMEO Outfitters, I'd like to welcome and thank you for joining us for the CMEO Snack titled Current Emerging Best Practices for the Timely Screening and Diagnosis of Mild Cognitive Impairment due to Alzheimer's Disease. The CMEO Snack series is supported by an educational grant from Novo Nordisk. I'm Dr. Alia Zayatri. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for Banner Research. I also direct the Banner Sun Health Research Institute. I'm a cognitive neurologist. I take care of patients and families with Alzheimer's related disorders. And today I'm joined by my distinguished colleague, Dr. Anna Burke. Anna, welcome. Please introduce yourself to the participants.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Anna Burke. I'm the director of the Alzheimer's and Memory Disorders Division at Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona.
Great. And so we have a busy program for you today. We want to frame the discussion. So let's review the objectives. Our goal is that after this CME snack, you can utilize a multifaceted approach for the timely case finding and accurate diagnosis of MCI due to AD and other conditions by evaluating risk factors, the approach to testing, symptom recognition, the tools that we have, including imaging and biomarkers. So this is gonna be a very packed program. So Anna, to get us started, can you give us an overview of the population with cognitive behavioral impairment and dementia due to AD and related disorders, and the importance of really of a timely and accurate diagnosis now and even as we're really having these emerging therapies?
Yes, well, as most of us already know, dementia and Alzheimer's in particular is really one of the greatest challenges facing our society currently. We estimate that every 3 seconds, someone in the world develops dementia. So in 2019, it was estimated that about 15 million individuals were dealing with dementia around the world. Those numbers are projected to increase significantly, in fact, almost doubling every 20 years. So by 2030, we anticipate 78 million individuals will be struggling with dementia. And by the year 2050, it's 139 million individuals. This is obviously not just an American problem. While the Americas anticipate that by 2050, we will have about almost 30 million individuals suffering with dementia, Europe is expected to have almost 19 million, Africa, 16 million. And our colleagues in Asia are actually going to be the most significantly impacted, with over 67 million individuals struggling with dementia. So the global impact is tremendous.
And you know, one of the issues is sort of timeliness of diagnosis.
And Ali, how would specialists work with our colleagues in the primary care setting? Because we know that most of these patients are interacting with primary care physicians, not necessarily with specialists. So how do we improve early diagnosis and timely diagnosis of these types of disorders?
Yeah, you're completely right. It has to start with primary care clinicians who really have the trust of the patients and have the long-term relationship with them. I don't have a simple answer. I do believe that we need to do much, much better through, you know, primary specialty care partnership models to identify the importance, especially now with biomarkers and treatments that are really targeting the underlying biology of, you know, who it may be at risk. You know, what can be done in primary care and when to refer, and the pathways for both, diagnosis and co-management. Hoping that the EHR and other things will help us, but I know with the advent of biomarkers coming more widespread, including fluid biomarkers, I think that's going to be, along with the treatments, taking on more valence. It's going to take some time. Yep. Let me ask you something about the approach, and this is very open-ended, basically, how do you think about the approach to the biopsychosocial environmental factors that put individuals at risk for cognitive impairment and dementia? And in general, what's your approach to the evaluation process, including review systems, using validated assessments, labs, studies, and particularly contextualizing this in the framework of the new revised 2024 Alzheimer's Association criteria for diagnosis and staging?
Right. Well, when we look at patients, we know that there are certain risk factors, some that are modifiable, some that unfortunately we have no influence on, right? So starting with some of the established dementia risk factors that we know of that we can't modify is age. Age is probably the greatest risk factor. So as we're looking at the population, we know that the longer you live, the more likely it is that you will have failure essentially of different systems within the body, whether it's the heart, the kidneys, the liver. The brain is no different. So the longer we live, the greater the risk of developing dementia. That risk seems to increase more significantly after the age of 65. We also know that gender or sex actually has is a significant risk factor. Being a woman increases the likelihood of developing dementia. In fact, nearly two-thirds of individuals struggling with dementia are women. We don't quite understand those risk factors. It's likely related to some of the perhaps hormonal changes that occur during menopause, but they definitely do increase that risk. And then there are some genetic risks that can increase the likelihood of developing dementia, and in particular, Alzheimer's disease. Although I do have to stress that the rare autosomal dominant mutations, the single gene mutations, are a very small portion of the AD population. Only about 5% of patients with Alzheimer's disease, early onset Alzheimer's disease, have these autosomal dominant mutations. But there are other factors like having one or two copies of the APOE4 allele that can certainly increase the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Now, there are some modifiable risk factors that we know of and that we try to counsel patients about. Modifying these risk factors through proper lifestyle, through cognitive engagement, can actually be helpful in reducing the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease or other types of dementias over your lifetime. And these risk factors include obesity. We do know that midlife obesity increases the likelihood of cognitive impairment, not to mention other medical conditions that are associated with cognitive impairment and with dementia. Physical inactivity, even though physical activity has improved over the course of the past decade, it still is relatively low, particularly in the United States. So we can definitely modify those our lifestyle to improve this. And then we know that having a low educational level, not stimulating your mind for much of your life, actually increases the likelihood of developing Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. So the more you stimulate your mind, the higher your cognitive reserve, and the more likely it is that your brain will age better. There are also other factors, such as depression, that can increase the risk of dementia, smoking, diabetes, hypertension, hearing loss is a big one as well. And then anything that really will increase the risk, cardiovascular risks, as well as inflammation throughout the body, can be a potential risk factor. Now you asked, how do I look at patients? How do we evaluate patients? Well, that is actually changing. In prior guidelines, it's important to note that the diagnosis of dementia was really a clinical diagnosis. It was based on a thorough clinical assessment, as well as ruling out any kind of medical issues that could potentially be mimicking that dementia or causing some kind of cognitive impairment. So it was based highly on the skill of the dementia specialist, whether that be a psychiatrist, neurologist, or geriatrician. We are starting to look at the diagnosis in a very different light because of recent improvements in diagnostic technologies. So the new diagnostic criteria that is in development is looking not only at the clinical presentation and again ruling out any medical issues, but also starting to incorporate some of the biomarkers that are available. And the diagnosis is really based on confirmation of the presence of amyloid pathology in Alzheimer's disease and is likely starting to trend towards other assessments of biomarkers that may be helpful in assessing for neuronal injury, inflammation, and so on. But right now, really focusing on amyloid confirmation. As we assess patients in the clinic, there are several stages of assessment or several elements that are vital. So the first is really making sure that you are obtaining a thorough history and obtaining that history not just from the designated patient. Unfortunately, we are dealing with memory issues, and asking somebody with short-term memory loss to remember what they've forgotten and tell you about what they've forgotten seems kind of ridiculous. So it is important to have some kind of care partner that is involved in that initial interaction with the physician. That can be a spouse, a partner, an adult child, or even a friend that or confidant that has adequate interaction with that particular individual. It's important to gather a thorough history reviewing the patient's cognition, their daily function, any kind of neuropsychiatric symptoms, changes in personality or behaviors that they may be noticing, and a very thorough review of systems, assessing for any potential medical issues that, again, could be contributing to their cognitive impairment. And as we're looking at that history, we are looking for patterns. We're looking at how did things start? How did they progress over time? What kind of symptoms was this patient noting, or the care partner noting? And based on those patterns, we have some idea of what might be happening because something like Alzheimer's disease may have a slightly different pattern than, let's say, a vascular dementia or Parkinson's dementia, or even depression or anxiety causing problems. It's really important also to run additional testing to check for reversible causes of cognitive impairment. So this includes blood work, looking for metabolic abnormalities, infectious causes, anything from hypothyroidism to, gosh, hypo or hyperglycemia, liver, kidney abnormalities, things like that. Also, looking for depression, anxiety, uncontrolled obstructive sleep apnea, or any signs or symptoms of NPH is important. So here we're also looking at neuroimaging, for instance, and the physical and neurological examinations, seeing if we can find any abnormalities that would point to a physical cause. Assessing the patient's medications, any over-the-counter supplements. We forget that oftentimes these medications and these supplements may have cognitive side effects. So, is there something that we can eliminate from the patient's regimen that may help? And then looking at other risk factors and health-related behaviors. Are they exercising? Are they sleeping well? Are they getting proper nutrition? Are there any toxins or toxic substances that they're exposed to? For instance, alcohol or drugs. Reviewing their developmental history, their social history, their family history may also hint at what may be happening. And then having some kind of structured assessment, as far as the level of change in their cognition and their function, mood and behaviors, as well as sleep and any sensory motor function. So for this, we may use brief standardized cognitive assessments. There's a variety of different assessments that is available. For the cognitive assessments, we oftentimes will see things like the mini mental status examination, MoCA or SLUMS, or even the mini COG being used. Now, all of these have potential issues associated with them and potential benefits. And we have an outline that we can review in just a moment of what those are. But using some kind of tool to assess cognition and to be able to monitor cognition over time. And then some kind of functional assessment as well. There's a variety of different functional assessments, but to ascertain where that person is in their daily function, in their daily activities, that will help us to stage the illness from a clinical standpoint, of course. And will help us to determine if there are any potential supports that would be beneficial in this individual's life.
So up to this point in your clinical approach, you're really, focusing in a patient-centered way, seeing what the changes are, what level the changes are, the patterns, and getting a sense of whether this is subjective cognitive decline, or is this really at the point of mild cognitive impairment, or, has this gone to the spectrum of dementia where individuals, are not independent, on some functions. And then the next step, I guess, is to think about etiology, right? And so that's what we have now between our imaging and our other biomarkers. So how do you contextualize those, and how do you think about those?
Well, so first of all, like you mentioned, we're ruling out any medical issues, right? So we're assuming that through the neuro standard structural neuroimaging, through laboratory studies, we are ruling out any potential medical issues. We're looking at patterns on the history. We're looking at patterns on the pen and paper testing, possibly obtaining additional neuropsychological testing if necessary. But then, in terms of etiology, that has been a very difficult task for even the best specialists, right? We have oftentimes been wrong about the underlying etiology of a patient's symptoms based on just those clinical assessments. So this is where our understanding of the disease and the types of tools that may be helpful is starting to change. And the recommendations in use of underlying of biomarkers is really emerging. And we have different types of biomarkers that are becoming available. These include plasma biomarkers or blood-based biomarkers, CSF biomarkers, as well as imaging biomarkers that may be helpful in whittling down that diagnosis. Now, Ali, you've been involved quite heavily in biomarker development. So, as we're looking at different categories of biomarkers, can you run us through some of the biomarkers that are emerging right now, those that may be available on the market? What should we also expect in the future?
Sure. I'll take us back to the proposed 2024, revised criteria for Alzheimer's disease diagnosis and staging. That doesn't tell us clinically what the pathway is, but really taking, as you mentioned, the diagnosis into a biological realm, that there's a biological Alzheimer's disease, and clinical manifestations, usually don't occur till decades later. And so, in that proposed framework, there is categories that are core categories to define Alzheimer's disease. And again, some of this is for research, and not all of it is ready for clinical care yet. But the core category is there a amyloid beta proteinopathy? So both, is there a tau proteinopathy? And those can be measured in different ways. There are sort of the core ways that they're suggesting is through CSF, and now some of the blood biomarkers in particular labs are very, very accurate. It's going to take a year or two before that is available for the clinic in a mass production to have that reliability. But things like p-tau 217, 231, and of course we know that molecular imaging amyloid PET can tell us about the plaques in the brain if that's elevated or not. Same thing with tau. Tau PET is probably the most advanced in that way. And then there's a definition of biomarkers that are involved in the pathobiology of AD, but they're not core. So they're secondary. So when you have the amyloid proteinopathy, it's sort of toxic kindling. You get the tangles. That's the fire. Amyloid is feeding the fire. But basically, neuroinflammation is another way to spread this fire. And ultimately, you have these biomarkers of neuronal injury, dysfunction, degeneration, or inflammation. And we're not quite there yet with those for prime time. NfL and GFAP are proposed. As far as anatomically, FDG PET and MRI can tell us about patterns of atrophy and hypermetabolism that go along with neuronal injury. And then finally, there's biomarkers of non-AD co-pathology, as you mentioned kind of earlier. When you have a disease, it could cause damage to blood vessels and also induce other proteins to aggregate, like synuclein. So alpha-synuclein is another one, and measures of a vascular brain injury are another, that are being sort of investigated. But they're not, not all of those are ready for prime time.
Again, we have imaging and fluid biomarkers that are helping us to understand the underlying pathology, right? The amyloid proteinopathy, that are helping us to understand the damage and the neuroinflammation that is becoming evident, and any kind of co-pathology that is emerging. Some of these biomarkers can assist us in also staging the disease process, correct?
Yes, I think you may have thrown this to me earlier, but I didn't probably answer it right. As far as what's available clinically, it's mostly the amyloid and tau PET, and of course reimbursement is always a consideration depending on your insurance. CMS is now covering the amyloid PET scans, and then there's also spinal fluid that has the regulatory approval. And then I think we sort of hit a little bit the AD clinical continuum, which is different from the pathobiological continuum. So people could have amyloid and really not have symptoms. So they could have that and. There is a biological staging that has been proposed that maybe you can review very, very quickly, because I think that's very, very complex, and that's still sort of, I think, in the research realm.
I think we know that there are numerous changes that actually begin fairly early on in the disease process, even prior to patients presenting with clinical symptoms. We know that amyloid buildup begins about 10 to 20 years before people start to show any kind of clinical symptoms. So that really is an initial stage biomarker that can be tested for either through amyloid PET imaging or through CSF or even blood-based biomarkers. As the disease progresses, we do know that there are other biomarker changes that can help to stage the biological disease. So, for instance, we start to see tau building up in the brain. And again, through tau PET imaging, we can start to see in the early stages that there is this buildup in the medial temporal regions. As the disease progresses, we start to see more moderate tau PET positivity in the neocortical regions. And then in the advanced disease, we do see that we have more of this tau PET positivity in the high neocortical or high neocortical uptake of the PET tracer. So we're going from just amyloid positive to tau positive and to different regions of the brain being affected. We also tend to see these core fluid biomarkers that start to emerge and can be tested for in the different stages of illness.
Great. So, as we're sort of wrapping up now, would you kind of summarize what may be the key steps for you and a timely diagnosis of AD and sort of very broadly?
So, in terms of a timely diagnosis of AD, I think we want to identify individuals as early as possible in their disease process to give them the best chance at one, slowing the disease process down through various means, whether that's lifestyle, whether it's some of the emerging new therapeutics that are available. We want to make sure that we have an accurate diagnosis, right? So, in looking at this, we do have to incorporate not just proper clinical diagnosis, but also look at potential biomarkers that may help us diagnose these patients at earlier stages of illness. These may include imaging biomarkers. These may include blood-based biomarkers. I think with time, we will be using blood-based biomarkers at much at earlier stages of the diagnosis, even in the primary care setting. I'm not sure what your thoughts about that are. Do you see these
I think
biomarkers?
they're coming. I think they're coming. We're probably still a year or two away that the validation needs to occur both in broader real-world populations and also practices. And that's occurring right now. Those research studies are being done. All right, I think we're out of time. So I think I'm going to summarize our SMART goals, specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. Hope you were able to follow along with us and we achieve the goals of the risk factors, the approach to timely and accurate detection and diagnosis of cognitive behavioral symptoms, including MCI, and the discussion of the approach to the assessment and from labs to studies to biomarkers, and that hopefully you've got more familiarity to recognize these and as some already available clinical practice, but as others emerge. This is a CMEO snack. It's one of a three-part series. Hope you'll take advantage of the other two in the series, where we'll discuss also neuroinflammatory pathological changes associated with disease-modifying treatments in AD, as well as a review of the current and emerging disease-modifying therapies for AD. And a big thanks to Dr. Anna Burke for joining us today and really educating us about these exciting advances and evaluation and diagnosis, and to you, the audience, for participating and being partners for us for the best care of patients with Alzheimer's disease and related disorders. Thank you and be well.